intellectuals to more general issues involving the sort of authority that knowledge carries in society, and in particular the role of expertise. Okay, and the issue of expertise, if you've got a copy of the knowledge book, there's an entry on expertise. It's getting to be a very hot topic now in the sociology of science, the kind of thing people would do PhD dissertations on. The question about expertise, in a way, arose last week in the lecture because one of the ways in which philosophy distinguished itself from intellectuals generally was by institutionalizing knowledge in a way that created a kind of authority structure, right? And you might recall I pointed out how Plato, for example, required that people who went to his school would have to matriculate for most of their lives, basically, right? They had to be disciplined in a way before they would be allowed out. And then, in a sense, by our standards, these people would be experts in statecraft, right? They would have the kinds of skills needed to actually be able to run society, okay? And the idea being that the kind of knowledge you got was very distinctive, disciplined knowledge removed from the public sphere. And, of course, when we give lectures in classrooms, and you know, we talk about the protections associated with academic freedom, there's a sense in which we're containing the space as well. Right? We're in a way, this is not exactly the public sphere. This is something that's closed in a way. And in the Middle Ages, of course, things were even more closed in, because basically the only way in which you could have textbooks would be by copying what I'm telling you, because you couldn't just buy these books, right? You'd have to listen to me and write them down and make your own copies as I'm speaking. And that was the origin of the idea of lecturing. And then I mentioned at the end of the class that with things like the internet and you know, multiple modes of access to knowledge, starting with the creation of newspapers in the 18th century, you end up having ways of challenging the authority that knowledge carries. Okay, nowadays. Very traditional sites of expert authority are challenged regularly. And one thinks, for example, about medical practice, for example, okay, where people frequently not only looking for a second opinion from another doctor, but they are also going to the internet and trying to find out medical information for themselves, which they will then present to the doctor as sometimes opposing evidence, right, about what's going on. And sometimes the doctors actually learn something from the experience, okay? So the point here being that expertise is, in fact, being very much challenged in our society because we have these multiple accesses to knowledge. So then the question arises, what exactly is the value of expertise anyway? Okay? So far, the one answer that is clear from what I've been saying is that expertise, right, gives knowledge authority. And again, think about Plato, right, the way, you know, he structured society, believed society should be structured around authoritative forms of knowledge, right? So the philosopher king has the best form of knowledge based on many years of training, and that knowledge then allows him to rule the society. Now, Plato had a very interesting way of thinking about the way in which authority was transmitted through knowledge. I don't recall if I said much about this, but Plato believed in this idea of the noble lie, which is to say, the kind of knowledge that everybody else other than the philosopher kings ought to have. Okay, so Plato was basically a guy who believed that you should basically lie to people to pacify them. Okay, so he believed in the power of, you know, ideological propaganda and stuff like that. Some of you may have read the novel 1984, right? And in 1984, you know, in that society, right, there's constantly stuff coming through the TV saying how wonderful the country is, how it's winning all its wars, and it's just 24 hours like that. It's a bit like Fox News, you know? And the thing is that is kind of thing Plato thought was necessary, you know. So in other words, because you've got to understand, ordinary people will not be able to make sense of the kind of knowledge that the philosopher king has. So if the philosopher king were actually to justify terms of the knowledge he's taught in Plato's school, ordinary people wouldn't understand it. So then what is it that you tell ordinary people to keep them disciplined and in line? This is where the noble lie comes in. And this has been a constant issue with regard to expertise. Because expertise, on the one hand, presupposes there's a privileged form of knowledge, okay? But typically, if it's a privileged form of knowledge, what that means is that relatively few people have competence to actually understand it, because it requires such a long period of study, might require you're very intelligent, whatever. So then the question becomes, how does expertise get translated so that it can actually act as a form of authority? Right? Because it has to exert authority over the people who can't understand it. Right? I mean, you know, so you think about it, right? You go to your doctor, right, and you don't know anything about medicine, and this doctor is telling you all kinds of stuff, and you believe him. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Right? You listen to scientists, they say all kinds of things about the origins of the universe, whatever. You can barely make sense of what they're saying. They make nice pictures sometimes. You believe it. Now that's interesting. What's going on there? Why do you believe the stuff you can't understand? In fact, one of the interesting things that that public opinion research has come up with is, you know, as you know, in our modern societies, people often think that there is a trade-off between believing in science and believing in religion. Okay, and the interesting thing is that amongst the people who believe in religion, especially in the the Bible and so forth, and the holy books, they actually know more about the content of what they believe. That is to say, they usually read the Bible, they usually have some kind of understanding of the Bible on the basis of which they then base their lives, than the people who believe in science. Right? So in other words, people who believe in science know less about science than the people who believe in religion know about religion. And the people who believe in science are called rational. That's interesting. You see what I'm saying here, right? The point here is that, you know, there's an issue of what you believe, and then there's an issue of how much do you know about what you believe. And the interesting thing about living in a science-based society, where science is the primary form of expertise, is that it has this incredible amount of authority, very much like religion has had in the past, but people know much less about its content than they have about the religions they believe. Because after all, part of the way in which religious belief is typically exercised is through rituals that actually involve you in contact with the holy books and the doctrines, and you know, you've got to play them out in your lives and so forth, so you actually get to understand what it is you believe. But this is not so in science, right? You're supposed to believe in relativity theory. You're supposed to believe in Darwin's theory of evolution. You're supposed to believe in quantum mechanics. And anyone who's a rational person will say, yes, yes, yes. Okay, tell me what these theories are. What is it that you believe when you believe these things? And there you find, as you know, from public opinion research on these matters, people know nothing. But they believe those theories are true. They just don't know what they are. Now, there has been a comparable situation in the history of religion. And that is during the period when the Catholic Church was the primary form of Christianity prior to the printing press. Okay? So that is the period when we're talking about the Mass and all of the Catholic rituals and all of the Catholic teaching being done in the universities and the monasteries were all done in Latin, and the Latin was not the common language of the people. The Latin was kind of the, you know, the language of the learned, the language of the literate. And that the people, right, spoke these what were called vulgar dialects, which became the basis of the sort of the modern European languages. And actually the development of the printing press enabled those modern European languages actually to get formalized and codified in writing so that you could actually start to identify differences between the languages. Because as you know, if you look at the language map of Europe, if you look at the border areas between countries, there's a lot of blurring of dialects and languages and so forth. And you can imagine what it was like before the formation of nation states in the Middle Ages, where people were, you know, there was just like this continuum of speech with no clear differences, right? And it's only once you get writing and you get stuff written in those spoken languages that you start to get some clear differences formed. And then as nation states form, they impose grammars and things like that, which then standardize the way people speak and write. And all of that I'm talking about here begins in the 17th century and really doesn't get ahead of steam until the 18th and 19th centuries. Because it's really only in the 19th centuries that you start to have the nation states in Europe, in particular Germany and France, start to have nationalized school systems, which have, you know, like national curricula and stuff like that. That's only in the 19th century. Okay? So now you've got to imagine, if you're living before the 15th century, before the printing press, and you're an ordinary person, and you're a Christian believer, as all these people in Europe are, okay, how is the mode of authority of Christian knowledge being conveyed to you as an ordinary person? Well, first of all, the priests and all the religious authorities you would have run into would be speaking a language you didn't understand if they were speaking Latin. Now, of course, they could speak the vulgar languages if they were engaged in pastoral counseling, like in the parishes and so forth. But in the official rituals of the church, in the official writings of the church and so forth, it was all Latin. And you probably, as an illiterate peasant, didn't know Latin. But nevertheless, you went to the masses, you sang the hymns, often just mouthing the words, not knowing exactly what they meant. Okay? Now, I bring this whole example, and the whole thing about the Protestant Reformation was basically people taking control of the religion. And the idea being that, you know, you want the Bible in a language you can understand. Right? And you want rituals that are done in the languages you can understand. In a way that makes sense to your everyday life. Okay? And so this whole idea that, you know, religion isn't just something you do sort of on a Sunday in a great ritualistic Catholic Church kind of way, but rather something that's integrated in your life and becomes very much part of you, that's very much the Protestant thing. Okay, part of that is taking back the religious knowledge, putting it back in the people and taking it away from the experts. That was what all that was about, okay? And so now we live in a time, right, where, you know, if one is practicing one of the major religions, especially, certainly true with Christianity, that, you know, probably the Christianity you practice is done in the language you normally speak. And you're reading Christian stuff in those languages, in the languages that you normally deal with. This is not a trivial point. This is one of the things that breaks down forms of expert authority by being able to have that religious knowledge done in your language. So the whole business about the Bibles, you know, you go in the hotel room, you have the Gideon Bibles, right, these kinds of things. The whole point of having those Bibles, right, was to, you know, they're in every language of the world, and they're simple, right? The Bible, those Bibles are written in very simplified language, simplified versions of the language, you know, you happen to be in. It's all deliberate, and it breaks down authoritative structures. That's remnant of the Protestant Reformation. Okay? Now, you might say that if we're talking about breaking down the forms of authority that expertise carries with regard to scientific knowledge, right, you have to imagine something like this has to be going on, right? And so the whole point of, for example, having multiple sources of knowledge, where in a sense, you know, in order to find out about medical knowledge, you don't need to get a medical degree. You don't need to understand, you know, everything the doctor understands. There are other ways of finding out simpler things, right? And you go to the internet or you read, you know, Medical Practice for Dummies or something like this, and there's this whole variety, this whole continua of literature out there and forms of information that in a way start to break down the barriers between you and the experts. And again, this is something I think that we very easily take for granted, but it's a very profound thing. And it's one of the things that leads people nowadays, and this is when people talk about our living in a new age period, okay, that what they mean is this tendency of people to kind of mix and match different forms of knowledge in their everyday lives. So, for example, the medical profession throughout the world, certainly in the Western world, is very much down on homeopathy, right? And generally not very keen about holistic medicine. And very much sees this as a kind of either-or thing, right? In other words, you either take the scientifically accredited medical practices, or you are doing this holistic homeopathic stuff. But of course, ordinary people don't see it this way at all. Ordinary people basically mix and match. They, you know, they say, I'll have a little of both. You know? I mean, who knows what'll work? And people have a, you know, and in a way, you know, sometimes the doctors think people are incredibly naive about these things, but in fact, given that all of these cures, you know, are only things to which one attaches probabilities to, it is not completely stupid to want to diversify your medical portfolio, because you never know in your particular case what's going to work. have and so forth. And those things are rarely included in the formal studies because, you know, people are so different from each other in the way they live their lives. Okay? So the thing here is that people tend to want to mix and match and have a kind of free hand in the forms of expert knowledge that they incorporate into their lives. Now, if that's the case, then one of the things that happens is that expertise loses its absolute authority. Right? It becomes much more, people start treating knowledge like they're going into a supermarket. I'll have a little of this, I'll have a little of that. Kind of cafeteria maybe, right? You mix and match, you put them together, you might return some to the shelf if they don't work. You know, money back if not delighted kind of thing, right? If you start to get into that sort of market mentality with regard to knowledge, you are pushing away from expertise. Because the whole point about expertise, right, is monopoly. Right? So when we have the church Latin, and that's the only way in which you can find out about Christianity, right? That's a monopoly on the transmission of religious knowledge, right? When the medical profession says that you should only be going to certified doctors, that is a monopoly, right, on the way in which medicine is practiced. Right? So this business of expertise, exercising authority in society, does have to do with the monopoly privileges of knowledge. And this is why Plato was so keen, right, that only certain elite people actually knew what was going on, and they had free rein in dictating to the rest of the society. But once you break the monopoly, and you allow for lots of different forms of knowledge to flourish, and you give people a free hand in what the, how they select what they're going to believe, then the whole illusion, whatever, the fantasy of expertise disappears. And again, the history of religion is very interesting in this regard. Because one of the things, if you think about it from the high church days of the Catholic Church, when everything was done in Latin and there was a lot of incense being spread around and everything in the churches, right, and with all the big cathedrals and things like this. I mean, one of the things that's very striking about this, especially you've got to imagine you've got medieval peasants inside these buildings, right, is that they're meant to be incredibly impressive. Right, the rituals, everything, it's like overpowering you with the presence of God through his mediators. Right, so in other words, that kind of authority structure of religious expertise is imposed on you in these very impressive ceremonies. Okay, now, if you look at the Protestant churches, by contrast, you know, I'm especially thinking about the low churches, not the Anglican church, which is kind of like copycat some of the Catholics, but Methodist, Baptist, these kinds of people, okay? Typically, everybody's on the same level, right? Maybe there's a guy in the pulpit who's there for a couple of minutes, but the point is this tendency, everything's sort of flat, kind of plain, right? A general suspicion about ornamentation and razzle-dazzle, right? They want you to focus on the message, and they want the message to be integral to your life, and the mode of preaching that goes on is one that is trying to, in a way, persuade you, right? It's not like, you know, the Catholic Church, when it says, I read the Bible out loud, and, you know, it's true regardless of whether you believe it, and if you don't believe it, you're damned, right? Rather, in the Protestant churches, it's like, you can tell from the sort of, especially the evangelical side of Protestantism, where the preachers are actually trying to pull you in, right? In a sense, they're making it seem like they care. They say, you know, it's your life, you should do this. You know, it's like a sales pitch. And in fact, of course, you know, if you look at the history of public relations and a lot of this kind of management stuff in the 20th century, especially in the United States, it's a very fascinating subject if you ever want to study it, is this kind of transition of people who begin life as preachers, moving into this kind of business guru. So, for example, Dale Carnegie, I don't know, you may have heard of him. You know, this is the, you know, How to Make Friends and Influence People, right? The Power of Positive Thinking, all this kind of stuff that was supposed to empower people so they could sell vacuum cleaners better in the 1940s and 50s, okay, in the United States. Well, this guy starts off with his life as a lay preacher. Okay? Now, that's not accidental, because in those low Protestant churches, right, the idea here is that the way you make your knowledge relevant to people is by personalizing it. This is, you know, this is God's word for you. And that's why the evangelicals are so kind of fervent about this. Right? So it's like a sales pitch. It's very much, and this is the modern sales pitch, descends from this kind of lay preaching in Protestantism. Okay? And so what that shows, you know, what's the point of this? Well, the obviously, if you are operating in a religious market, essentially, right? In other words, where the Catholic Church no longer has a monopoly over religious knowledge, but rather what you have are lots of different churches that are being allowed to compete with each other for saving the souls of humanity. So there's a kind of common pool of potential customers out there, i.e. Christians, people who think of themselves as Christians with souls, and souls need to be saved, and there are lots of ways you can get your soul saved, just like there are a lot of action figures out there, right? And so what you have to do is you have to start delivering sales pitches. Okay, and so the whole evangelical thing, especially in Protestantism, which gets more and more intense as you move from the 16th to the 18th to the 19th to the 20th century, just gets more and more intense as they got more and more churches proliferating, right, is to personalize it, to personalize the religious knowledge to you. Now that is a world that has moved completely away from expertise. Because basically, the value of the knowledge is not going to be in the kind of authority it intrinsically carries because of its origins in terms of having studied for a very long time and all this kind of stuff. No, it's the value of the knowledge is going to come from what it can do for you, the customer. Okay? And again, this is very much like the business world. Right? Where the value of the vacuum cleaner doesn't have to do with its technical design and stuff like that. You don't actually buy it and use it. You know, I may have the most scientifically beautiful vacuum cleaner in the world, right? That, you know, all the physicists think are wonderful. Okay? But nobody buys it. Okay? That's my fault then. Even though it's technically the best vacuum cleaner in the world. Well, the thing is that this is kind of the way in which the religions have to think about themselves. It's not enough to have fancy doctrine that makes perfect sense to theologians. You actually have to have a form of religious knowledge that appeals to people. Okay? And so this kind of business of breaking down monopolies on knowledge, right, and turning it into a kind of a market-based activity whereby the consumer, in a way, dictates a lot of the terms of the arrangement, this is one of the ways in which you can chart the decline of expertise. Okay? You know, so, for example, I mean, one way in which you could start to see the erosion of expertise in this kind of market-friendly way happening in the medical profession is that there are all these calls now, and some of our medical sociologists are involved in this, to kind of reform medical education, right? Because in the past, right, the way in which, you know, medicine sold itself was as this scientifically sophisticated subject, and so the curriculum was mainly front-loaded with a lot of heavy-duty biological knowledge, biochemistry, molecular biology, all this kind of lab-based stuff, you know, so that the doctors would be taking these exams and have all this very sophisticated knowledge of all the stuff that's going on inside of you. Big problem is, though, they couldn't communicate with people. No bedside manner, that kind of thing, okay? There was no provision for that in the curriculum because the authority of medical knowledge was thought to come from its scientific basis. Well, in the last few years, precisely because people are getting fed up with this, right? They can't understand what their doctor's saying, they find their doctor arrogant, you know, they're not really paying attention to them, right? They want more from their doctor. They don't just want mumbo-jumbo, okay? Now there are these moves to make doctors into human beings, okay? And sometimes sociologists are brought in to help, you know? So give the medical students a sense of what are the social contexts in which healthcare is being delivered. I mean, maybe you guys, maybe you've even taken some courses where you've had some medical students in the classroom. I mean, and this is getting a bigger and bigger growth area for sociology in terms of people that we hire in other sociology departments. This is regarded as a very marketable skill within sociology to actually do sociology of health and medicine. Okay? And part of it is for the reform of medical education, to make doctors more humane. Now, why do you want to make doctors more humane? Well, obviously because they're feeling the pressure that people are going to other sources for their medical care. And so this is like one step in the direction toward medical evangelism, where the doctor listens to you and tries to appeal to you, right, kind of understands how your mind works and, you know, tells you right things at the right time and doesn't just overload you with science up front and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so this is a little step in that direction. And in some places, some medical schools now offer options so that you can actually study a little bit of homeopathy and New Age stuff, so you can, you know, at least familiarize yourself with a few techniques. And some of the more rigorously tested versions of New Age knowledge, like acupuncture, for example. Acupuncture has, you know, there's some places that take, you know, that actually get, it now gets medical certification. Okay, and with a lot of the other stuff, there, you know, I'll give you an example. The National Institute of Health, which is the big research, government-based research funding agency in the United States for medicine, now has a whole research division devoted to testing and potentially improving New Age treatments. This, again, was against what the medical profession wanted, but the government thought that this is something worth investing into. So as it were, raise the standards, in some sense, get a sense of what are these forms of knowledge about, how might we improve them, integrate them with conventional medical practice. Now, what's driving this? Again, it's a consumer-driven thing, right? What the government is seeing is the fact that people are turning away from conventional medicine, for better or worse. They're doing it. And so, the medical profession and the government's got to catch up. And this then changes the whole character of how medical knowledge works. So then the question arises, is this a good thing? Because, you know, there's a, you know, one of the, you know, one way of telling this kind of story I've been telling is it's about the democratization of knowledge. Right? So in other words, in the beginning, knowledge is just this authoritarian expertise, whether we're talking about Plato's Republic or the Catholic Church or scientific medicine, right? And that you basically have a monopoly, it's in the hands of the experts, and everybody basically just has to obey in the beginning, right? But then over time, right, we get this democratization. That's to say, the people who previously were subordinated to the knowledge, their voices get heard more and more. And as their voices get heard, they start to have impact on the character of the knowledge that is being put forward by the experts. Right? So the character of expertise changes. The whole matter of relating knowledge to people changes. You start to get this kind of marketization, this kind of evangelism, where knowledge has to be sold to you. You can't assume that people are just going to go for it because they have no choice. Rather, you have to actively sell it to them because they're competitors. Okay? And this can be described sometimes as a democratization of knowledge. And then the question becomes, is it a good thing? Is it a good thing? Now, some people, and one sociologist I would mention in this regard, who wrote a very interesting book about 30 years ago now, called The Credential Society, and you may have heard of him, Randall Collins. He writes about lots of stuff in sociology. Has people heard of him at all? Randall Collins? Okay, maybe an introductory theory course or something. Well, he wrote this book 30 years ago called Credential Society. And there, he talks about this issue of expertise and all this, and the way it interacts with democracy. And he makes an argument in the book for what he calls credential libertarianism. Okay? And credential libertarianism is basically this kind of devolution, democratization of expertise that I've been talking about, taking that to the ultimate extreme. Okay? And the idea of credential libertarianism is basically that it doesn't matter what kind of knowledge, let's say, medical doctors have. Right? So in other words, you just totally devalue the learning, the credentialing part of it. So, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they got their degrees through an online course. You know, the University of Phoenix in the United States, so you may be familiar with University of Phoenix. University of Phoenix is a completely online university with 400,000 students. Okay? No classes. Lots of just online tutoring. You take exams, you pay your money, you get degrees. I've actually been to academic conferences now, and this is the sign of the times, where there are people who actually now, when, you know, they will be introduced, they will say, Ed, he got his PhD at the University of Phoenix. And holds an academic post. And I say, whoa, what's happened here? Because this used to be considered totally slumming it intellectually, right? To do a, you know, do your degree on an online course, you know. I mean, this is not the Open University we're talking about here. This is much lower rent stuff. I mean, this is stuff where everything's online. I'm serious. There's no books, no TV shows. It's just online, okay? And you pay money, and as you pay money, more stuff comes online to you through a password, and then you eventually do your course. That's what we're talking about here, University of Phoenix. Do-it-yourself learning, okay? 400,000 people in the U.S. are matriculated here, and some hold academic jobs, okay? Well, so that would be kind of the real extreme credential libertarianism. I might be a medical doctor, and how did I get my medical degree? I went to the University of Phoenix. You know, in 30-minute bursts. When I had spare time, you know, I'm really a telemarketing person, but then every now and then when I'm not, you know, trying to sell customers linoleum siding or something like this, I actually do a little work with the University of Phoenix, and then after about 6 months, spending 30 minutes at a blast, I end up with my MD. Cool, right? And I might be able to do that for maybe a couple of thousand pounds only. Okay, that's credential libertarianism, where, you know, it doesn't matter, right? You could get your degree that way. But what does matter, here's the thing, right? What does matter in credential libertarianism in terms of trying to talk about the value of knowledge in society, right, doesn't come from the credentials, but it comes from the track record. Okay, the track record. Because here's the interesting thing, right? When you think about something like Plato's Republic or Church Latin or any of these kinds of forms of knowledge as expert authority, right, in a sense, the content part of the knowledge that gives it the authority, right, comes from the training. Right? It comes from the way you're front-loaded with stuff. Right? You learn certain disciplines, certain skills, you spend a certain number of years in school, and it's all very specialized training. And that is supposedly the thing that entitles you then to have this authority in society. Now, credential libertarianism is against that, obviously, right? Because it says you could start with a pretty superficial upfront loading. You could be at the University of Phoenix. Okay? But then what does count? Well, what counts is track record. That is to say, what is your record in using the knowledge that you claim to have? In other words, I don't care whether you got your degree at Oxford or the University of Phoenix. What I care about is how many patients die when you treat them. Okay? That's what we're talking about, track record. So I'm not interested in, you know, the quality of your training. I'm not interested in your exam scores, right? I'm not interested in the letters of recommendation from your former teachers. I am interested in your track record, in the thing you claim to be expert in. Okay? So, if you're a doctor, how many die? How many live? How many have adverse side effects? I want to see it. And then not only do I want to see that, I want to see that in comparison to your competitors. And I want all that information at my fingertips. And that is going to be the basis on which I will decide who I am going to trust with my life. Okay? And I don't care, I don't need to know where you got your degree. Or even if you have a degree. As long as I know your track record, and that can be reported accurately. Okay? Now, in the, I don't know how many of you are familiar with American consumer politics, but there's a man who in a way is kind of an inspiration for a lot of this kind of thinking. You may have heard of him, a guy named Ralph Nader. You ever heard of him? Ralph Nader? He was a presidential candidate when Gore lost. In fact, he's the one who's often blamed for Gore losing because he took votes away from Gore. Ralph Nader he's now about 70 years old. He's like this ultimate consumer activist. He's a lawyer by training, right? And he came up with a magazine in the 1960s. And I remember when I was a kid, you know, in single digits, this man was the kind of thing that your teacher would always tell you about as a, you know, good citizen and a man who's really doing some good for people. Ralph Nader. He started this magazine called Consumer Reports. And in a way, there have been a lot of spin-offs from this idea, and sometimes they're on television, and you'll know exactly what I mean in a moment. What the magazine does, basically, is it'll take a category of good, like a car, and the automobiles were actually the thing that was really hot in the 1960s here, and just compare them on a lot of different dimensions. Like, if you crash the damn thing at 30 miles an hour, do you live? If you crash it at 50 miles an hour, do you live? Does the person you crash it into live? Right, and you ask all these questions for a variety of cars. then, you know, you ask things like, how often will you need to get the wheels changed? How often will you need to change the carburetor? You know, and you just go through the whole list of things. And you compare all these cars that, of course, you know, cost various amounts of money. And then they do, and then you can look at this, and you can think to yourself, okay, I want to spend X amount of pounds on a car. I don't want to die, though, so maybe I should spend a little more. You know, and you have all that information at your disposal. Okay. The Consumer Reports doesn't tell you anything about, for example, how long has the manufacturer been in business. Right? It doesn't give you the backstory. It doesn't give you all of the, you know, this was the car of the year in 1957 or something. They don't tell you that stuff. They tell you the consumer relevant stuff. The consequences of driving the vehicle. What is likely to happen based on tests that Nader's researchers did. Okay? Now you see, you got some, nowadays, of course, you've got the spoof versions of Jeremy Clarkson type stuff, right? And in a way, it's kind of a almost like a satirical version of this. But in the 60s, this was dead serious stuff, okay? Because it really started to galvanize a kind of consumer sensibility that, in a sense, they could really, they could dictate the kinds of products that are manufactured by their buying practices if they know the full range of options and their consequences. So, of course, what this meant was that with a lot of goods, a lot of small, relatively unknown producers could make big inroads into the market. Right? Because you're looking, again, at the consequences. Right? You're looking at what follows, what works, not just what's famous or what has a backstory that's prestigious, but what actually works. And this was really radical stuff. In fact, when I remember as a kid, when Nader was first putting out this magazine, the big automakers in Detroit were complaining, and they basically wanted to stop the magazine for publication because they thought that this was going to actually be disruptive of business. That this was like selling trade secrets or something, to actually let people know whether you'll die in the car if it crashes at 30 miles an hour. There was originally objections to this. You know, it's violating trade secrecy. Imagine that, huh? Well, that's the way people were originally thinking about it. Because what the big car makers wanted was for people to have to make their decisions about cars based exclusively on the advertisements that the car producers provided, which, if you think about it, typically do appeal to the prestige of the line and various evocative things that the car is associated with, you know, but not necessarily with the things that really matter to the person driving it. Okay, even today, while some car manufacturers do advertise this kind of consumer-relevant material in their ads, it's still relatively rare. I mean, most people still are full of atmospherics when it comes to car advertising, and this is true of everything else, okay? So Nader was very important in getting this on the table, and there was one particular car called the Corvair, which just was awful. I mean, it was a very sporty car, so people found it very attractive to drive, but like when it crashed, you know, everybody died. You know, the car just was like, you know, sardine can, you know, it was awful stuff. And that was kind of the one, that was the vehicle that the whole movement sort of concentrated on, because it was this very flash, sporty car, but it just crashed and burned. It was awful. Now, so the point is, imagine everything, could you do everything like this, okay? So now we've got the Consumer Reports mentality with regard to, you know, ordinary goods, right? So, you know, it's not unreasonable that if you want to buy a car, or you want to buy a vacuum cleaner, you know, you go and you read a magazine like this and you look at all of the different options and how they function and all the dimensions, and then you make a judgment, okay? Now, could we do that with, let's say, GPs? So imagine now, right? Warwickshire. All the GPs in Warwickshire, line them up, column after column. Then we've got the dimensions on which we're going to compare them. How many patients die? You know, how long does it take to actually see the doctor? You know, all these kinds of things that would be of concern to people. And then line them up and have people then just presented with this evidence. And this evidence can be regularly updated on a monthly or yearly basis or whatever. And then people can make their choices, right? And there'll be a lot of factors people would consider. How far away the GP is, you know, waiting time, what kinds of treatments, etc., etc. be a good idea. What do you think? You see, this is the thing, right? Credential libertarianism would basically say that's the way to go on everything. On everything. Everything that at the moment requires serious credentials is to look at track record and look at track record in a market situation. That is to say, against competitors. Because it really doesn't make any sense for you to, you know, how can you evaluate one doctor, even if you had information about the doctor's track record, if you just have the one doctor, it's hard to know whether he's any good or not. Because you want to know, okay, what are the others like? Okay, this doctor here, 6 people died last week. But God, everybody else, 18 died. Well, he's not so bad. Okay? This is why you just can't have track record for one person. You need track record for a whole population of competitors in the market. But assuming you could get that information, what would be wrong with credential libertarianism? Okay. Now, it's an interesting, I mean, let's put it this way. This is regarded as very unattractive. You're not going to get the medical profession pushing this line at all. Okay. And in fact, one of the big problems with it from a practical standpoint is that we don't actually have systematic ways of accumulating the relevant data. Okay? See, in the case of the cars and the vacuum cleaners and things like that, you know, Ralph Nader and his researchers can just go out there and buy these things, right, and test them out. Right? A bit like Jeremy Clarkson, right? Crash into things, see what happens. Do I die? No. You know? Okay, good. Check that one. Right? So the point is you can buy the goods, you can check them out, you can do your own tests, in other words, on them. Now, you can't really do that, you know, with GPs, if we're talking about their track records, and, you know, how many patients, what happens to them, and so forth, you're pretty much relying on self-reporting. Right? The doctors give, you know, if the doctors are willing to cooperate at all, right, you're stuck with their fingers. First, they probably won't cooperate, and if they do, they'll lie. Okay? So it's very hard to get reliable figures, and something like the National Health Service, in a way, does try to do something like this for hospitals, entire hospitals, right? And that's very, and as you know from a lot of the, you know, controversies surrounding the management of the national health care, that in fact, this is very difficult information to get in any kind of reliable way. People are lying.